Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Kind of a small group today. It's understandable. But what a beautiful morning. Wow. Such a beautiful morning. I'm going to start out with a poem. A poem called The Snowman. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place. For the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself, beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. That's by Wallace Stevens. Did you want to hear it again? Or is that enough?
Again. One more time.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the first time you sort of go, oh, I missed some words. The snowman. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place. For the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself, beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Wallace Stevens, I believe he said that poets were like mediators of silence. They express silence. They should express silence. That's a paradox. So, here we are. We're going to talk today about the eight worldly winds. Do any of you feel you've been buffeted by the worldly winds in the past? Of course. We've all been buffeted by the worldly winds. And some of us at Zen Center are doing a practice of bare awareness, just sitting, or zazen. Some are doing breath counting. Some are also adding metta or loving kindness practice. Some are practicing self-compassion. And all of those are really great. And this is the place to do all those practices. Because this isn't a time to practice too much alone. This is a time where we need to connect with each other. So, knowing what our intention is for our practice, being aware of what's inside, what's outside, and watching what comes up, and sitting with that, and being with that, that's the practice that we do here. So everything has changed since November, but nothing has changed. Our practice says, our tradition says, nothing has changed. Everything has changed, and nothing has changed. Well, what am I talking about there? I'm talking about what hasn't changed is nature, reality itself, as it isness, that thread beneath the eight worldly winds. You can just follow that thread like they do in blizzards in North Dakota. You have to put a rope out from the farmhouse to the barn so that in a blizzard you don't get blown away. So this practice is our rope, it's our thread. And, you know, our ancestors have been doing this practice for hundreds of years. This practice goes back to times when there was war and famine and drought and dictators and oppression. And our ancestors kept doing this practice no matter what. In the time of Shitur and Matsu, who were contemporaries, there was a terrible war going on, the Loshan, I think it was called, rebellion. And there are just massive amounts of people being killed and dying. And according to Joan Sutherland, Roshi from New Mexico, they kind of played two slightly different roles. Shitur sitting in on his rock and just being there for people that came to see him, just being really open and kind, and then Matsu going, "This is it. This is reality. This is what's happening. You know, get with it. Practice like your hair's on fire, because it is, or it will be in a minute." You know, so those two. Interesting. I didn't know that before I taught the class on the ancestors. I didn't know that about the rebellion and what was the context of their teaching at that time. So here we are. The eight worldly winds and the practice of compassion is what I'm going to talk about. Tim talked about turtle practice in Sesshin. He said, "We do turtle practice." And sometimes, like a Galapagos turtle, like a 100-year-old tortoise, it takes some time to develop the ability to keep our equanimity in the midst of the strong winds that blow in life. So it takes time to build patience, diligence, you know, set your intention. Repeat. So the eight worldly winds are gain and loss, praise and criticism, fame and disrepute or shame, happiness and unhappiness, or pleasure and pain, however you want to say it. And I'll add a fifth pair, hope and fear. I guess the Buddha didn't talk a lot about fear in the early scriptures, although he did talk about giving the gift of non-fear to others as a way of saving beings or freeing beings, giving the gift of fear. But he didn't talk about fear as a big impediment, but I'm going to talk about that. So here's Gil Fronsdale. Becoming attached to or excessively elated with success, praise, fame, or pleasure can be a setup for suffering when the winds of life change direction. Have you ever experienced that? Where everything was going your way and you were just on top of the world in your world anyway, your little world. And then all of a sudden, boom, you're down. Yeah, most of us have experienced that. So have you also experienced, maybe you can think back to when you were younger, when you were in your 20s and your ego was really strong. and the first time you noticed how, you know, proportionate it was, the fall, to how attached you were to the high. Do you remember that? I remember that. I remember that. So success can be wonderful, but it can lead to arrogance, and it can without humility. Carl Jung used to say, so we'll have to tell Ben this, because Ben has a new book out, by the way. Last night he did a reading, which was fabulous, Inside Vasubandha's Yogacara. And so Ben's kind of like on top of the world now, because his book just came out. So you know what Carl Jung says about that, Ben? No. To avoid the psychic backlash, you should be sure to take the trash out on a very regular basis. Do some humble. And the thing that's great about Zen practice is that's what it's all about, you know. Wash your bowls, take out the trash, you know, do the next thing. Clean the toilets, nothing is beneath you. So that kind of helps us, right? In case we get too. So let's see. So yeah, and identifying, if you become invested in praise, you can that can tend toward conceit. Identifying with failure, we might feel incompetent and then or inadequate and not try to do something with this precious life. Investing in specific kinds of hope and being attached to an outcome, we may have a fear of loss. And when it doesn't go our way, when the outcome changes, we can fall into anger and despair. So right now there's a lot of angry people around, I've noticed. And some days I feel angry, you know, about what's going on in the world. But I've just noticed there's a lot of angry people. And for instance, on social media, there is there's a lot of, you know, snide jokes about our new leader, and you know, it's easy to fall into that. It's easy to fall into that, but it has an effect on our mindstream to do that, and it doesn't really help us to build compassion or metta kindness if we practice it on the cushion and then get online and post trash talk about, you know, people. But it's hard. It's really hard. It's a hard thing. So we're more likely to stay on an even keel in life if we realize that our inner well-being is not dependent on the worldly winds. So Ajahn Chah, revered teacher in the Thai forest tradition, here's he is explaining the word worldly and world. This is the world. One who is lost in the world is easily overwhelmed by it. He who's lost in the world has no means of escape and lives surrounded by confusion. I think Ajahn Chah is more like a Matsu kind of guy, you know. The Buddha offered us the Eightfold Path, which mediates and eliminates the world. The world of the eight winds is in our minds. And when these winds are in our minds, the world is born. This is still Ajahn Chah talking. But the mind is also the place where the path arises. So the worldly dharmas or winds and the wisdom, ethics, right action, livelihood, speech, mindfulness, etc. of the Eightfold Path are a pair. They're a pair. They exist in the same place, our minds and our hearts. And in our minds is where the path sees the world. The path sees the world. So when we sit down, and this is a lot like Dogen, right? What out of delusion arises awakening. Effects, and like you said last night, samsara and nirvana are one. So right in the same place where delusion arises and where attachment to any of these pairs of these worldly winds comes up is where the path is to apply to that. So the path sees the world, he says. When we practice with our minds, we see in them the arising of the world born of desire, of wanting. Wanting is the birthplace of the world, he says. birthplace of the world. So wanting is another name for desire. Desire is the cause of suffering according to the Four Noble Truths, right? Desire or grasping. Grasping sometimes is easier to understand than desire. So we could see our wanting play out, some of us, in the election. We wanted so bad a certain outcome, some of us. I did. And there are people that I know who were even more hopeful of hope, and some were full of confidence that turned out to be misplaced. And the more invested, the more painful it was for them, you know, the results of the election. And it was painful for me, too. I'm not saying I was above that fray. I was not above that fray. So more than ever, you know, this wanting, we can see it, and what happens when the outcome turns out differently than we want it to. And this time of year, there's another kind of wanting that comes up. People are like, wanting things, and you know, or wanting to give things, and we get caught up in all of that. So this is a great time of year to actually just slow it down, be like a turtle. You know, let this weather slow us down. We're running all around, and the busier we get, the more we should sit down. Really. It seems like that doesn't make sense conventionally, but this isn't about convention. This is about entering the stream through going upstream against the against the stream. So realization is right there in practice and not outside there somewhere. You all know that. And practice isn't easy. We come here looking for peace. We sit down, and then up comes all this stuff. You know, desire arises, and wanting, and judgment of ourselves and others, and just everything. All the full catastrophe. It's all there, you know. And but when we meet it with diligence, with intention, with just coming back again and again, just like a fool, like an idiot, just doing the same process over and over again, over time, it weakens the forces of ignorance in our own nature. And then we become lighter and brighter, and we're able to let go quicker. So even if we don't become, you know, gain complete perfect enlightenment, such as they mention in the Heart Sutra, still helpful to do. And what else have you got to do, right? What else have you got to do, Roger? Run around making money, doing your business. These guys call that laziness. These teachers. I didn't say it. Ajahn Chah, these guys say that. So he goes on, the Dharma practitioner must become one who witnesses the Dharma for himself. He or she knows whether the worldly Dharmas have left or not, whether the path has been developed. And right view grows as wrong view decreases. So then he talks about friction. Friction in practice. He says, this path requires endurance and creates friction. And he said he knows Dharma students who come and they just want to be peaceful. They don't want any friction. They want everything to be chill and cool and zen. You know how that word is used? Zen equals chill and peaceful and no problem. But actually choosing to go against the stream of the culture and to sit down with our minds, it creates friction for us. Creates a certain friction, which is fine, because then we can experience frictionlessness through friction, through being with friction, through being with What does it feel like when your desires are frustrated? Don't like that. What does it feel like? I mean, sesshin is a setup for that. And retreats as well. You come in and you all your toys aren't here and your favorite foods aren't here and there's no Netflix. It's just, you know, sitting there bare, looking at a wall and following a schedule. And so that's creating friction. So when you tell your friends, oh, I'm going off to retreat, and they go, well, you're lucky, you say, no, you don't know what you're talking about. There's no massages. So if he says, if there's no friction, then we're not doing it right. Then we're just following our desires, Ramakrishna. We're following our inclination. We're floating down the Apple River in a inner tube with a beer in our hand. You know, we're not doing practice if we're just following our desires. If there's no friction. Now, you don't want so much friction that you just become overwhelmed and say, that's it. I'm leaving. I will never come back. But some friction. When our desires are thwarted. And he goes on, the Buddha's teaching is contrary to our hearts. People want to indulge in greed or hatred, but Buddha won't let them. Buddha won't let us. The light of awareness will not let us. They want to be deluded, but awakening eliminates delusion. The world calls the body beautiful. He says it's not beautiful. Buddha says that. They say the body belongs to us. He says it's not so. This is right view. But we usually merely follow the river downstream. So, this is about surrendering the story of the self. You've heard this phrase before, no self, no problem. Well, it's, you know, the minute you think it or say it, you think, that's not very kind. That's not very compassionate. No self, no problem. Sure. Who can do that? Maybe Buddha can do that. According to Ajahn Chah, Buddha was given 8 blades of grass by a Brahmin as a gift. And he took it and he sat on it and went into samadhi. And in that way, he conquered the 8 worldly winds, because those 8 blades of grass symbolized the 8 worldly winds. So here's a koan story from our tradition. I'm mixing up traditions here. Just as Ben said last night that he says Yogacara is like sort of this interesting bridge between Theravada and Mahayana. So that's what I'm doing today. I'm bridging. But here's a koan story from Daedalorium. The national teacher and the emperor of China were entering the palace grounds when the national teacher pointed to a stone lion and said, Your Majesty, would you please say a word of Zen? Something profound about this lion. And the emperor said, I can't say anything. Would you please say something? And the national teacher said, It's my fault. It's my fault. So the national teacher was taking responsibility for the full catastrophe of life and what goes wrong and suffering. And so what we usually do is we like to, well, not you, of course, but just people in general like to blame others and you know, kind of play the victim and say it like, oh, she made me angry, so it's her fault, and there's nothing I can do about it. And so then we're passive and we don't do anything. Whereas if we take responsibility like the national teacher, then we're empowered. We're empowered to do something, you know? So keep that in mind with this whole chaotic scene that's playing out in the world. This is Ajahn Chah again. Oh, I missed some of that koan. There was a really good... Oh, here it is. Here it is. Okay. The prologue to the koan. Confined in a cage up against the wall, pressed against the barriers, if you linger in thought, holding back your potential, you remain mired in fear and frozen in inaction. If, on the other hand, you advance fearlessly and without hesitation, you manifest your power as a competent adept of the way. A competent adept of the way. That's all of you. Passing through entanglements and barriers without hindrance, a great peace is attained. So how do we do this with fear? We engage fear in our sitting. We engage fear in zazen. We let it come up. We let ourselves feel it. Fear about what's happening in the world. Fear about our security. Fear about, oh, there's lots of fears. And then the underlying current of fear that experienced practitioners discover. For instance, when they sit alone in a cabin for a month, like I did, that underlying current. I knew I wasn't imagining it. Taita Lori says, that's there. Okay. So as soon as we start ruminating on fear and getting our minds involved, and then we start projecting, then we're caught again. We get become frozen. So we counter that with building concentration through zazen, through meditation, coming back to the moment again and again. Here's the capping verse. I like this capping verse. The cave of the blue dragon is ominous. Only the fearless dare to enter. It's here that the forest of patterns is clearly revealed. It is here that one ripe pearl is hidden. So the cave of the blue dragon is our minds. Our minds in sesshin, our minds in retreat. The cave of the blue dragon. And there's this ripe pearl. It's hidden in plain sight. It's hidden in plain sight in the cave of the blue dragon. We find it through sitting with our patterns, sitting with what comes up, being intimate with it, not looking away. We have our breath, we have a posture, we have a place to do it. There's really nothing to fear but fear itself. So here's Ajahn's conclusion about the eight world winds. So there is truth in this world. Trees, mountains, and vines all live according to their own truth. They are born and die following their nature. It is just we people who aren't true. We see it and make a fuss over it, but nature is impassive. It just is as it is. We laugh, we cry, we kill, but nature remains in truth, is the truth. No matter how happy or sad we are, this body just follows its own nature. It is born, grows up and ages, getting older and changing all the time. It follows nature in this way. So understanding this, we can have compassion for ourselves. By extension for others, knowing that we're all in the same boat. We're all working with our minds to be more accepting, to flow with life as it unfolds, as we age and cells die, and maybe some other cells grow, but in general it's going the other direction. And so how do we do that gracefully, you know? We can look at nature. What does nature do? Why is a tree in the forest so inspiring to me? I don't know. And science now says it's because it's giving off all these chemicals that make me feel good and make my endorphins and all this other stuff. But before we had this information, I just felt it. I just felt strength and stability and beauty and the and awe in the presence of a tree. So compassion. Now we're getting to compassion. So compassion is just to be open to suffering our own and others. One of the definitions of it that Sharon Salzberg gives is that it's the quivering of the heart. The quivering of the heart at the suffering of others. So it requires, it's not nicey nice. It's not a veneer of niceness that we put over how we really feel inside, which right now I'm really angry, but I look really nice. You know, it's not that. It's not that. It requires cultivation. It's based on developing equanimity and wisdom, the ability to know what is out of our control and what we can do something about. In the moment, case by case, it's always changing. So it is not speaking out. So some people feel like they're compassionate Buddhists, so they don't speak out about what's going on or about injustice. But that's really fear. That's not compassion. That's fear and timidity. It's not being overwhelmed or shattered with an overload of grief, which then turns to despair and anger. It's not that. That's not compassion. I mean, it's okay to be overwhelmed by the world. We are, from time to time, overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed sometimes by the world that's happening. But if we are overwhelmed, that's all right. We can just use the ground to... If we fall on the ground, we can use it to get back up again. We can use our Sangha friends to help us get our perspective back, get our intention aligned when we feel overwhelmed. We can have the intention of being a protector as much as possible, protecting all living beings. Sharon Salzberg tells a story about the Dalai Lama that you know, he said in one of his books, "I don't know why people like me so much." And then he says, "It must be because I really try to be compassionate, to have bodhicitta, the aspiration of compassion." He says, "It's not that I succeed, it's that I really try. Really sincerely try it." You feel this sincerity, right? He gets angry. He's admitted to that. He gets angry. So we can use the Sangha to help us. We can take refuge in awareness, in the Dharma, the teaching, the practice, and our friends, the Sangha, when the worldly winds blow us around. So what am I going to do after this election? Well, I'm going to continue to teach and lead, facilitate practice discussions and show up for people as a chaplain. And I'm going to write letters and sign petitions and call people. And I'm going to continue to affirm my intention to be a protector of beings. So what I'm going to do, what are you going to do? What are you all going to do? So I want to end today with this poem from Elizabeth Bishop. I kind of like to bookend my talks with poems. Called One Art, and it's about the art of losing, how we can practice, because we don't like to lose, we don't like loss so much, but it's there and it happens. So this is her instruction on how to play with that, even when you're not especially when you're not losing things. And this morning I practiced that. I thought I sent the email with attachment with the talk over here. When I got here, it wasn't here. So I had to get in the car, run home through lots of snow, and only took 20 minutes. Subarus really know how to track snow. But, you know, we need this practice because we forget things. So here it is, one art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident. The art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. That's it today for what I have to say. I hope that it was encouraging to you. The thing about Zen is it isn't about being chill all the time. It's about looking at what is. The naked nature of our being, our minds, our own our programming, you know, and we're very vulnerable. We're vulnerable to suggestion quite a bit, right? Politicians and advertising people really know that quite well. And we have found that some of our fellow citizens recently are quite vulnerable to certain thoughts and beliefs about how reality is. But that same vulnerability is in us. So, to be clear-eyed and really see what is. We start here because this is where we can learn about human nature, right here. We don't need to, you know, say, oh, look at them, they're doing this, they're bad, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to do that because we can find it all right here. Right? So that's what this practice is about, partly, is freedom, but also it's really waking up to our what does being human mean? What are the joys and what are the challenges and what is our hardwiring about, you know? Anyone have a question or want to make a comment or burst into jubilant song? Doesn't look like it. Oh.
I'm not going to articulate this well, but now that we're living in a post-truth world, the idea of what is felt more clear to me a few months ago than it does now, and more shared than it does now. And we do that.
Yeah. I think what we have to do is to really educate ourselves, you know, to really to really understand what the sources of the news that we take in are and whether they're reputable, to seek out the company of people who we trust and feel have a reasonable grip on reality, and to resist those messages that we just, that our gut just says, that's a lie, you know? So to resist. Yeah, one of the things I read about totalitarianism is that, or fascism, is that people just give over their power right away without even the power being demanded from them in many cases. So we don't have to do that, for sure. You know? We have to be awake. And it's been hard. It's a hard awakening to know that there are people coming into power on a national level who seem less invested in the truth and whose motivations are about amassing power. It's hard to look at that. That's why we need each other. You know, and our practice of sitting with difficult emotions and with whatever we're attached to, whatever we're in the grip of, it actually helps us, you know, because if we can get more in touch with how we delude ourselves. Delusion, according to Buddhism, is the hardest to see, the hardest to notice. It's just so close that we don't see it. You know, I don't see anything. There's some lines and blob, and you know. So that practice is really helpful for us. You know, but we have to continue to cultivate, I think, compassion and friendliness. So one of the things I'm doing is reading. I read a book recently about someone from a background completely different than mine, who's American and in a cultural region that's completely different. And through his memoir, I could see how his relatives and not him, but his relatives came up with their political and social beliefs, you know. There were a number of different influences going into that for them. And I'm completely different than that. That's not, but it was helpful for me to read that, and I'm committed to continue to try to see, because I really realize that I've been living in a bubble, kind of a liberal, white, privileged bubble with other people like that. This room is filled with them, right? So I met a friend on the stairs yesterday, and I said, how are you? And he said, well, I'm doing fine. I'm a white male in America. He said, it's the other people I'm worried about. And I thought, oh, that is so sweet. You know, I'm glad I know you. I don't know if that helped. We all have to find our own way, basically. You know, we have to find our own way in this situation. But the more we stick together, I think it's very helpful. Charlie?
Yeah. Back to the election. I don't get real involved in talking to people about politics. I try to stay clear of politics most of the time. But previous elections, we've done well. And I remember bringing up something to this lady at the gym, and it didn't take me long to find out where she was coming from. And she was not very happy, and she was really got ugly about it. And I not to throw rocks at her or anything, but just seeing her reaction, and I'm thinking back on her now, and that's not how I want to come across to people as being ugly about what happened. And I thought that was really a kind of a good thing to keep in the back of my mind.
Because
that isn't going to help us or them or anybody else.
Right, I agree. Well, you know, the other thing is, I'll tell you that back in 1980, that's December 8th, 1980, John Lennon was killed. And that was such a blow to me, such a terrible blow. My son had been born that year, so he was just a newborn. And then, you know, if you remember, a month later, Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as our president. So what I did then is what I vow not to do now. What I did then is for the first 5 years of that decade, I basically turned my back on public civic life of any kind. I just focused on my baby and my personal life. I hated the music of the 80s. Now I like it. But at that time I hated the music. I hated the politics. I was sad. I felt like it was just like the lights had gone out when Lennon was killed. And so that's how I reacted. But I vow not to do that this time, not to go into a cocoon and stay there until things come out more the way I want them to. So just staying awake, doing what it takes to stay awake. Now we should be done, I think.